Peter Baker is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. His wife, co-author Susan Glasser, is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Their latest book is just out in paperback tomorrow, actually, The Divider, Trump in the White House 2017 to 2021. The Divider offers the inside story of the 4 years when Donald Trump went to war with Washington, from the chaotic beginning to the violent finale. A lasting history of the full Trump presidency that also contains dozens of exclusive scoops and stories from behind the scenes in the White House, from the absurd to the deadly serious. The new edition also features a fresh afterword addressing Trump's current efforts to return to the White House. It is a pleasure to welcome Peter Baker and Susan Glasser back to the roundtable. How are you both?
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Really nice to have you both on the program. Well, a lot has happened in the last year since we had you on when this book first came out. I'm curious as to it. Man, it's tiring to live through it. What is it like to write about it?
Well, it can be a little tiring too. It's exhausting. We thought we were past it, obviously, and now we have sort of two full-time jobs, right? You have a sitting president who is a pretty full-time job, and a former president who wants to be president again is a pretty full-time job. But one thing that we thought was really interesting about the book was, you know, when we wrote it, we thought it was a work of history. I think now, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a work of prologue. We didn't realize quite how important it would be toward forecasting ahead what a second term might be like. If you understand what a second term of Trump will be like, go back and look what really happened behind the scenes in the first term.
Susan, when you look at it, just taking on this project initially of trying to write that history, of putting that 4 years, and I think by all accounts, by admirers and by extreme critics, that can be politely termed as tumultuous.
Tumultuous is a very polite term for what happened here. I mean, let's, you know, right, like the honest assessment of Trump's term in the White House would be not only a level of sort of chaos and turmoil in terms of the basic running and functioning of his White House, unprecedented levels of turnover, volatile and abrupt shifts in policy, an extreme case of choosing again and again what Trump thought of as his personal interest over, you know, the national interest. All those things are outliers, really, in American history, right? Those are what marks Trump out as very different from presidents of either party. Somebody said, you know, Donald Trump combines the most extreme flaws of many of our recent presidents, but all rolled up into one. And so that makes him a unique challenge to write about. But Peter, I think, has got the important point here. It's the past is prologue part that really strikes us a year after the publication of the book. Now that we're looking at the paperback edition, what's the big difference is that essentially he's promising to run a second term that would be a retribution for all the things that he wasn't able to do in the first and all the enemies who went after him along the way. Now that he's facing these four criminal indictments, you know, I think we're looking at a really unprecedented situation.
The name of the book is The Divider, Peter, and I'm interested in how you want us to understand that term and that descriptor for the 45th president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, every president on some level, you know, gets ahead in politics by dividing. I mean, politics is about division to some extent. My policy is better than your policy. My candidate is better than your policy or your candidate, and here's why. But never, I think, have we had a president whose whole modus operandi was polarization and dividing the country. You know, other presidents at least gave lip service to the idea that this is not a blue America, not a red America, but one America, as Barack Obama said, or that he would be a uniter, not a divider, as George W. Bush said. You never heard that from Donald Trump. That's just not the way he operates. He wants to, in fact, divide the country because that's how he has gotten ahead. And he polarizes by race and ethnicity and religion and party and ideology. ideology and geography and culture in order to appeal to a base that has been very fervently, you know, supportive of his. And they like that message, the message that we are somehow being, victimized by the others, whoever the others might be. That's been very successful for him so far in maintaining this minority, but enough of a minority to get ahead.
Susan, when you talk about the getting ahead part, here is someone who, on a regular basis, every day, almost every moment of every day, is talking about how people are, how aggrieved and how horrible people are treating him. And yet, there is a following, and there's a very large following, a following large enough that has him as the front runner for the Republican nomination. What does that say about how he comes in and is, and what people do think about him and what he has achieved, when it is so often beyond anything we could imagine or have thought of as quote unquote normal even 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that from the vantage point of history, you can't look at those polls right now suggesting that a former president of the United States who was the first in American history to attempt to overturn a legitimate election, that he would be running even in public polls with the incumbent president of the United States is such a statement about where the country is at right now. And I think that it requires an incredible amount of self-reflection and of understanding of what, you know, is this a country that, you know, we thought it was? Are we believing, you know, sort of our own fairy tales? There has never been a more untruthful president in the United States. And I'm saying that because, of course, all politicians, to a certain extent, spin the truth, put their own gloss on events. Donald Trump, as he showed again just the other day in that interview with Meet the Press on NBC, is a fire hose of lies. And yet, you know, where we are as a country is in a place where a very large, not a majority, but a very substantial minority of the country is willing to overlook things that would have been disqualifying for any other public figure.
So what is it that I know I'm getting a little psychological here, Susan, but it's just I find it fascinating. I mean, we had a very smart, a very respected former congressional representative in our studio who is Republican, was Republican, ran as a Republican, certainly has his issues with Donald Trump, and yet was defending many of the things that he was saying in that Meet the Press interview. And I'm just curious as to how the division in the country, that divider aspect that you write about, is that how we can look at that so differently and not see that for being, I'm sorry, as the way I viewed it, was really unhinged.
Yeah. Well, of course it was.
Go ahead. We'll go Susan and then Peter. Go ahead.
Of course it was. Of course it was. That's the extraordinary power and part of extreme partisanship, right? That tribal affiliation, team sports aspect of it means that, you're willing to excuse even egregious failures in on the part of the person that you're cheering for. I think that psychological aspect to politics is very well established. I also think look internationally. There is this. We are not an outlier in the sense that there is actually kind of a lot of experience, unfortunately, with the kind of charismatic right-wing nationalist populist type figure that Donald Trump represents. That is a very, very serious challenge to democracy. We've seen it happen in other countries that don't have the long history with electoral democracy that we have here in the United States, that it's resulted in countries essentially going from democracy to a form of authoritarianism. You know, see what's happening in Hungary in the last few years, in Poland, in Turkey, in other countries. And so I think Trump is in many ways running a classic, almost a textbook campaign of challenging our core democratic institutions.
Peter?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I remember, you know, one of the things that the vision has done, he's divided his own party and his own family at times. He has played them off of each other. But what the Republicans have learned is that challenging Donald Trump, even people who are out of office, like the person you're talking about, you know, gets them nowhere inside their own party, their own tribe, as Susan said, and in fact, usually punished. Where is Mitt Romney going to be 2 years from now? He's not going to be in the Senate. He's not going to be there any longer. And you don't see Jeff Flake or Bob Corker or Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger, or any of those Republicans who did speak out against him, have in their, you know, way of thinking about things paid a price. And some of them have decided to do it willingly because they think that's the right thing to do. But a lot of the other ones who are staying quiet, even though they don't like Trump and don't think he's good for the country, are afraid of the consequences that they see.
When you look at this book, and the book is so thoroughly reported, I would like to ask you, Peter, about consequences. We don't really know yet what the full consequences of that 4-year term from 2017 to early 2021.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. We don't know the answer because the story's not over yet. Because
right.
His story. Done, right? He could yet be in the Oval Office again. And even I think once he is done, we don't know what it means in terms of the institutions, and we don't know what it means in terms of the Republican Party. How much does Trumpism outlive Trump himself? Do we go back? So far, we have not like sort of snapped back to the way things were before Trump. But, you know, a different character would find it hard, I think, to do some of the things that Trump does so readily and so easily. And it's going to be an interesting test of the system in our country, what happens once he is backed off the scene.
Susan, why don't you think he has backed off sooner? In the sense of you go in, you do what you do, you lose the election, you make the claim that you didn't lose the election, but he certainly has had opportunities to say, okay, I'm done. Now, I realize that may not be in his DNA makeup, but it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the answer to the question is right there. It's just not, Donald Trump is the shark who's going to keep swimming until the moment he stops, right? And I don't think it's in his makeup. He is a natural, you punch me, I punch back harder. And that's why, you know, when we were thinking about how does this book stand up, you know, a year later, not a surprise that Trump was running again for president, maybe a little bit of a surprise that, you know, we've seen not one but 4 very serious felony criminal indictments launched against Trump. Obviously, we can't talk about the end of the story until we know how those unprecedented cases turn out. And, you know, look, we're talking about a guy who really is facing the real prospect of jail time. So it's an existential fight as he sees it, right? This is not a guy who is itching to end up in prison. And so that part of the story is unwritten. But Donald Trump, you know, he is what he is, right? And that is a big takeaway of the 4 years. So we better take him seriously. When he says that he'd be willing to terminate the Constitution in order to reinstate himself in power, when he says that his next term in office will be about retribution and revenge, we ought to take that seriously.
We ought to take it seriously, and yet I don't think anyone here and anyone that is listening to this program doesn't think that he has the power of winning, right? I mean, that I think in most cases you would think we used to live in a world where that would be a disqualifier, and now it seems to be a selling point.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, four indictments used to be a disqualifying thing.
Right.
Two impeachments might have been as well, but we obviously are in a different era, and Trump is a different kind of figure. Now, look. It's important to remember that he did not win a majority of the vote in 2016, even when he did win the Electoral College. He didn't win a majority of the vote, obviously, in 2020. His party lost the midterms in 2018 and didn't do as well as they thought they were going to do in 2022. And there's no reason to believe that he has actually picked up votes in a general election. He's dominating the Republican primary, but he hasn't exactly convinced independents and Democrats who voted against him in 2020 that, yeah, now they want to go with him. The difference is whether or not Biden can repeat what he did in 2020 and present himself as the credible alternative and restore, you know, bring back those people who backed him in 2020 but are now feeling kind of doubtful about him.
Peter Baker and Susan Glasser join us this morning. They're the authors of the new book, The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. It will be available in paperback tomorrow. It is published by Doubleday. I find it interesting, Susan, that just in the last week, as continue court action for the president or the former president for Donald Trump as to what's going to be heard when and how he's going to run a campaign through all of the court appearances, .. This also comes in a week where our current president is an investigation is being launched for impeachment. There is Peter's newspaper, The Washington Post, had an opinion piece by David Ignatius about questioning and prompting, asking for President Biden to step aside. It was the front page of the New York Times this morning of Democratic leaders sort of being a split on having Joe Biden as their candidate. What does that say about Trump that it brings out those weaknesses and concerns about a president who, yes, is elderly, but also it does have a record and has some legitimate things to run on?
Yeah, that's right. Well, first of all, it's not a coincidence, that Republicans are mounting a partisan impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives as Trump faces these metastasizing criminal cases. That is a core part of Trump's strategy to win another term in the White House, and that is, you know, this kind of mirroring. And that's something he's used to great effect politically, by the way, throughout his time in public life, which is to, you know, say it's sort of, it's not me, it's them. And generally when Trump is accused of something, in fact, what he's immediately going to do is to try to project that accusation onto his foes. And now he has a willing instrument in this sort of extreme faction in the House of Representatives that's pressed the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, to launch an impeachment inquiry, even though many of McCarthy's own members had qualms about it, knowing that there was no real evidence of any wrongdoing that would reach the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. McCarthy couldn't even bring this for a vote on the House floor because he wouldn't have the majority. So he went ahead and did it anyways to appease kind of his most pro-Trump faction in the House of Representatives. And I think, again, it's important to note this because it's not some coincidence. It's not that there just happens to be this organic investigation of Donald Trump. It's of Donald Trump's opponent, Joe Biden. These are interconnected. And remember, it was Trump's effort to dig up dirt, as he put it, on Joe Biden back in the 2020 election cycle that led to Trump's first impeachment by the House of Representatives in 2019 for essentially attempting to extort Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in order to get him to launch investigations of Biden. So, you know, what's old is new again, and that's the history that we're recounting in this book. But it's worth pointing out because Trump's playbook is Trump's playbook.
Susan, you writing in the New Yorker, you have a piece called The Rage of the Toddler Caucus on Capitol Hill. Not even a Biden impeachment can sue them out of a government shutdown. You mentioned just a moment ago about, you know, not a coincidence of this happening, but also, I mean, the government shutdown very much being a part of this story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. These two things are intertwined due to timing and now it's politics as well. And what was fascinating to me was the weakness it demonstrates. Of course, we've known this all along. Kevin McCarthy won back the House of Representatives in last year's midterm elections, but with essentially not a functional majority in the House, only five seats. And he has more than five members who are willing to make his life difficult at any moment. That's why it took 15 ballots for him to become speaker back in January. They now have this sort of permanent gun pointed at his head, which is that a single member can call for a procedural motion, a motion to vacate the chair that essentially would become a referendum on his speakership, and they could oust him almost at any time. So, you know, he's sort of been a more or less willing hostage to this extreme Trumpist faction within the House GOP. But I think now things are really getting real. You have September 30th is the deadline for government funding to run out. These Republicans are demanding all sorts of conditions, including the impeachment inquiry. Some people thought that was an in case of emergency break glass kind of measure for McCarthy coming back in September. And he went ahead and used it the very first week. And guess what? It didn't work. It didn't even work.
You start off that piece by saying if there's any lesson to take from the past few years of American politics, it is that things can always get worse. I don't know, Peter, I keep on forgetting that, and yet I keep on being reminded of it.
Well, it's a pretty downbeat kind of way of looking at things. Things can also get better, right? Maybe they will. My view of this, I get a lot of questions from people asking, you know, gosh, how will we come out of this period of you know, dislocation and polarization and ugliness? And I remind myself anyway that we have been through tough periods in our history and we have come out of them. And it doesn't, you know, it's not easy to say how, but we obviously fought a civil war and came out of that. We've had rough periods with McCarthyism and Vietnam and Watergate and Jim Crow and other periods. We have been a country that has endured tough times and continued to you know, make progress. So we'll see. I'm still an optimist about America.
So let me just ask about your piece in the New York Times about Biden's tough week and facing those personal and political setbacks. I don't think I've ever seen, or perhaps, but it is rare that the personal and the political are so deeply entwined as they are here.
Yeah, they are. You're right. I mean, you know, for a president who loves his son, his only remaining son, because his other son died, of course, of cancer. You know, the Hunter ordeal is deeply painful, obviously, and it's deeply painful not just because his son did something wrong and now has to face the possibility of a trial and maybe even prison, but also because it's become so political. And I think he feels he would like to defend his son. He would like to wrap his arms around his son. Hunter has come and lived at the White House for a few weeks at a time, you know, but that's problematic politically. His own allies would just as soon Hunter not be part of the conversation because it doesn't help them in any way. And they had that plea deal just a few months ago. It looked like they would finally get that part of it at least behind them, and it fell apart. So now we're looking at least one trial, maybe more. Nothing good, obviously, comes of that for the president. The best thing that they can say is so far, but voters do not seem to be making choices based on that. But it's obviously a painful and politically fraught subject.
Peter Baker is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. Susan Glasser is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Their latest book is just out in paperback, The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. It has been a wonderful morning spending time with both of you and talking about these issues. Thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you. Again, Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, authors of The Divider. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.